gentlemen. First case for argument is Hull v. Stoughton Trailers. Mr. Vernon.
Morning. May it please the court. The appellant and the plaintiff, Evan Hull, claims retaliation for exercise of his FMLA rights. He seeks to prove the case under the indirect method. The district court wrongly based its holding, dismissing the claim, on the understanding that Hull was required to prove decision-maker knowledge of the fact that he had exercised the FMLA rights. This court jettisoned that requirement in 2002 in the Stone case. For that reason, the district court case is wrongly decided on the law, and in addition, on many, many factual areas, inferences were not drawn in Hull's favor, and in fact, findings were made that were contrary to even to Stoughton's evidence.
Neither of the briefs that I, at least what I as far as I could tell, actually told us what Hull did, what his job is, what the factory does.
The factory manufactures trailers, and Hull was a line supervisor. At the time of his discharge, he was supervising the modification section at the end of the line, where discrepancies that have, in a trailer that have gone through the line are corrected before they're.
So this is an assembly line operation, and he's the supervisor of these workers.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Hull's evidence is that he had a ruptured disc in his back, and he first was released from work for 1 week by his doctor on November 10th. He returned to the doctor after that week on November 17th, at which time he was told that he should take 2 more weeks off of work.
And before you just outline the whole factual scenario, I'm sure we're all familiar with this. I have a specific question.
Sure.
About... Is there any data in the record showing how many of the employees who were disciplined for drug policy violations also took FMLA leave? You know, the reason I'm concerned about that is because I think you need this evidence to identify similarly situated individuals.
First of all, we've
got that list.
I understand.
But there's no indication.
We know the evidence shows that all 85 of them were treated better than Hull.
But are they comparable?
So in order for them not to be relevant, all 85 of them would have had to exercise FMLA rights. We know that at least half of them were ineligible for FMLA rights because the FMLA requires a one year time on the job before you can even. The rights even accrue. We have 40 probationary employees that are in the cohort, the 85, who were on the job for less than 3 months. We have an additional 4 or 5 non-probationary employees who are on the job for less than a year. So
now, what about the rest? Do any of the others fall into that category?
With respect to the others, there's no evidence that they exercised the rights,
right.
But there's no exercise that they didn't. The record is silent on that.
But isn't that a problem for you?
We don't need 85.
We cited cases
in our reply brief where we had 2. We know the evidence establishes that we have at least 45.
And you've said that, and I get that.
I get that.
I'm talking about let's take them off the table. What about those that are left? Is there a breakdown?
There is no breakdown in the record, no, Your Honor.
We don't know how many were supervisors who maybe had some performance problems anyway. I mean, that's the argument, that he was a supervisor, and from what you say, supervising the assembly line is potentially dangerous, heavy stuff and so on. And his performance wasn't great. So the best case for you would be if there were people like that, supervisors on the assembly line, not great performers, but being treated more leniently because they're not seeking FMLA.
The difficulty with that argument, for Stoughton to make that argument, is that their own HR director, Ms. Schilt, testified that the drug and alcohol policy is identical for supervisors as it is for hourly employees.
It doesn't mean it's executed in the same fashion, right? They might be less forgiving of supervisors, feeling that a supervisor who looks, drugged is a very bad example to the workers, and it makes them nervous, you know, being supervised by someone who's falling asleep.
But if the policy applies equally to both, and Hull happens to be the only supervisor...
Couldn't discovery have revealed, this following up on Judge Williams' question, more about these 80 people?
We had their personnel records, and we had...
Well, what did the personnel records reveal about their supervisory status and about their evaluations?
The record is silent on that, and in many cases there were no evaluations. In the cases, half of them, they were probationary employees that were gone before they ever had an evaluation.
Well, they're not relevant.
What about the ones that are left? There wasn't anything in there, the personnel file of the ones who were not probationary, that showed they had disciplinary problems? Because there's not even a breakout for that in terms of what you've shown to the court. In other words, you know, you said you had the personnel file. Is there anything in that indicating that they had some problems on the job? Not the probationary employees. You're saying that the employee records are just absent of any kind of performance evaluation?
No, that is not the case. If they've been there long enough.
So for the ones that have been there long enough, was there an analysis done of the ones who had drug policy violations that had bad work records or had some issue with job performance? Was there any analysis like that?
There was not.
Okay.
There was not.
And see, I think that's a problem in terms of trying to show, meet your similarly situated requirement.
Well, we contend that the drug and alcohol policy is a policy that applies uniformly across the board. You can reduce the comparable category to a category of one. You can say he has to be a supervisor, has to be there for 10 years, has to have Waleen as a supervisor. But I don't believe the cases require that amount of substantial similarity with respect to a company-wide policy that on its face is applied even-handedly, and when our evidence shows...
How can you say on its face applied even-handedly? That's a contradiction. There's the face is what it says, then there's how it's applied. They aren't necessarily the same.
It is mandatory in its language that...
No, companies do not... These are not laws, and companies often don't apply their rules in their strictest fashion. In fact, that's your whole argument, right? That they're laxer with respect to other people.
They're laxer with respect to people that don't exercise FMLA rights, correct?
Right, that's your argument. So, in other words, you don't think they execute this policy uniformly?
No, I think they do. I think our proof shows that they exercise the policy across the board without exception.
But then there's
in a rote fashion.
I understand you. If they implement it across the board without exception, there's no discrimination. I don't get you.
I'm saying the drug and alcohol policy is administered in a rote fashion. One strike and you get
But you don't think it was applied to your client. How can you say it's applied uniformly across the board? You don't think it was applied to your client.
I don't think my client was fired for violation of the drug and alcohol policy.
But you don't think it was applied uniformly because he wasn't given the proper, you know, progressive discipline.
And he's the only instance in which that
right,
happened.
Right, that's the whole point. You don't think it's uniformly implemented, this drug policy. You think there's at least one exception, namely him.
Because of discrimination.
Right. So it's not uniformly applied.
If we prove that it's uniformly applied at every instance except him, to me that's evidence
of... You haven't proved that it's uniformly applied. You've just proved that they have this policy. You don't know anything about its application.
We've showed 85 employees.
Well, we've been through that.
I want to just ask a question that's not related to that. One of the things that was alleged in the complaint was that his termination interfered with his FMLA rights, but it was never raised in summary judgment. There's no mention of it in the opinion.
Retaliation is the only
right
claim.
But isn't that a claim of direct interference of FMLA rights with that kind of claim, there's no requirement of proof of discrimination or retaliation, is it?
The elements of proof are different. That's correct.
Right. And that was not addressed by the district court.
It was not.
And nobody raised that.
That is correct.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Vernon.
Thank you.
Ms. Brooks?
May it please the court, good morning. I would like to address just briefly a few additional issues related to the similarly situated analysis.
On page 3, Judge Shabazz says that the defendant granted plaintiff's request for FML leave on November 11th. And on the next page, he says, Alfery, I assume that's the decision maker here, did not know when he terminated plaintiff that he had requested FML leave on November 11th. What was he granted leave, or had he just requested leave?
Well, he was granted leave. This is because of the size of Stoughton's organization. The Human Resources Department, through a person named Deborah Lee, issued a letter telling Mr. Hull that his request for leave was granted.
So he,
that was churning separately. Mr. Alfery knew nothing of that process. He was just presented with the information regarding showing up to work under what appeared to be an impairment.
So when he was terminated on, what is it, the 20th or the 17th?
Yeah, the 20th.
He had been on FML leave, company-granted leave, for a week or so.
That's right. That's correct. After he was asked to leave work on around the 10th, then he did not come back to work because he went to the doctor, submitted paperwork for the leave.
Do we have any cases that talk about people who are fired while they're on a grant of FML leave?
I'm not recalling any cases offhand, but I think that relates back to Judge Williams' question as to why this was fashioned as a retaliation case versus an interference case.
Yeah, because, I mean, it appears to be classic interference, but, of course, that wasn't really explored in the district court fully, was it?
No, it wasn't. Through the course of discovery, it appeared to us that Mr. Hull was pursuing the retaliation claim as opposed to the interference claim.
Right, and so there was no discovery directed toward it. The district court didn't look at it when it ruled on the summary judgment motion. That wasn't an issue.
Correct. Correct.
Do you have anything to add about what his job duties were?
Other than the fact that he was a supervisor, there's no other information in the summary judgment record on that point.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Let me just follow up on this interference. You agree that his medical condition was serious enough to entitle him to FMLA leave, right?
Correct.
He was, in fact, entitled to an additional 10 weeks of leave.
Correct. The decision to terminate him was made by a decision maker who was not involved in the process of granting the leave at all. He didn't know he had requested leave.
And so he should suffer the consequences just because there was not communication within the company
no,
that size?
No. Our position on that point is related to pretext. And the evidence is that Mr. Alfery made the decision to terminate and did not know about the FMLA leave. He did so for the reasons that were stated in his termination form, which is, there was a straw that broke the camel's back on November 10th where Mr. Hull appeared at work under what appeared to be an impaired condition in light of recent performance problems.
Well, would he have terminated him if he had known that he had been granted leave?
I don't know the answer to that question. Perhaps.
I mean, wouldn't that have been a question? Hey, can we fire this guy? He's already on FMLA leave.
If he had known, Stoughton Trailers has general counsel, and so I think he would have asked that question.
What
but
would
he
general
didn't.
Counsel have said?
I think that the general counsel would have said, your decision to terminate, although it might be high risk because of the timing, the closeness in timing, Your decision to terminate is completely independent of whether or not Mr. Hall requested FMLA leave. It's justified by the fact that at least three people saw Mr. Hall in such a condition that it looked like he was impaired, and this was on the heels of, and even though there's some dispute by Mr. Hall as to when his performance was an issue, even by Mr. Hall's own declaration, he concedes that it only on September 20th, which is only 30 days prior to the termination, there was an active performance improvement process in place for him.
Although, as you pointed out, there was no direct testimony that Mr. Alfrey knew of Hull's leave request, the fact that Stoughton rarely, if ever, fired an employee for an alleged first-time drug violation of, violation of their drug policy, create an inference that Hull was fired for taking FMLA leave. Especially when you look at the close proximity between Hull's request and his firing.
I believe that there are a number of cases that address that issue and whether or not there should be some imputation of discriminatory animus to Mr. Alfrey's decision or whether there should be some inference that he had knowledge. And I believe that the Alexander case addresses this issue. That's a 2001 case by this court, which says that when the decision makers for a particular decision don't have either knowledge of the protected behaviors and cannot be imputed with some sort of discriminatory animus by another person, that inference should not be made. I would also point to the decisions in the Clover and Brungart cases, which were cited in our briefs. I understand those were decided pre-Stone. Stone is the case where it said you can't analyze this pretext type of analysis in the prima facie case. But I believe that the reasoning applies just as equally to the pretext analysis, which is Mr. Hall cannot prove that Mr. Alfrey had that the real reason for Mr. Alfrey's decision was to discriminate against him or retaliate against him for taking FMLA leave if there's no evidence that Mr. Alfrey even knew that Mr. Hall had engaged in that protected behavior. Also, on another point, there is a discussion in our brief that there was a plant manager's meeting where Mr. Hall was discussed, and Mr. Hall did not take the depositions of those individuals at that meeting to determine if there was additional evidence to create an inference or that there was some lying or some other suspicious behavior so that the knowledge should be inferred to Mr. Alfrey. I would like to back up and just briefly address one other point on the similarly situated analysis, which is that the court touched briefly on it in its questions of Mr. Vernon. But that is that there are two other shortcomings in the 10-year summary that Mr. Hall provided. And that is, number one, he does not specify in that summary whether the termination decisions in those cases were made by any of the decision makers who are relevant to this case. Alfrey was the decision maker, but even if you somehow imputed the decision downward to Mr. Wallin or Ms. Patterson, there's no evidence or distinction. And that's particularly important here because if Alfrey denies knowledge of Hell's FMLA leave, then to even raise an inference of discrimination, it's material that how Mr. Alfrey acted with other employees, if there are any, who are similarly situated. And then the court asked Mr. Vernon, but if the court refers to the termination notice, which is in the record, it says that the termination decision was made because Mr. Hall showed up to work impaired, and then it goes on to say that it was and in light of his previous performance decision-making and failure to meet the performance improvement expectations as mutually agreed. And so there are clearly two parts to Mr. Alfrey's termination decision, and the 10-year summary is completely devoid of any information as to whether any of those other employees had similar performance problems. I believe I've covered all my points. If there are no further questions,
thank you. Thank you, Ms. Brooks. Mr. Vernon, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Unless the court has questions, I don't need much time. I just wanted to say that the identity of the supervisor who was involved in the discipline of the other 85 obviously has no bearing, given the fact that all 85 are handled in exactly the same way: first violation, second violation, discharge. With respect to Hull's job performance, if the inferences in the evidence are given in Hull's favor, as they're required to be at this point, Hull has produced satisfactory evidence that as of September 20th, when the 45-day probationary period expired, he was supposed to have been meeting expectations for that entire 45 days, or else he would be demoted at the end of that 45 days. His conduct was to be monitored weekly during the 45 days. He had no adverse comments either during the 45 days or after, and it was a full 2 months later and after he exercised the FMLA rights that he was fired.
But do you attach any significance to the fact that he was on FMLA leave?
Well, certainly.
When he was fired?
Yes,
well,
I do.
What's the significance of that?
Well, the significance is that, number one, he was on leave for a week, and then the fact that the leave potentially was going to expand to where it could get to the end of the calendar
that
year.
I understand. I thought that was your argument, that they didn't want him to accrue this additional leave. But what difference does it make whether he's fired while he's on leave or not on leave?
If the firing while he's on leave constitutes an interference with the exercise of the right, then it makes a difference.
Well, that's the theory you haven't pushed. But in any event, suppose someone is on FMLA leave and the company discovers that he's been embezzling. Couldn't they fire him?
In this case, the discovery...
No, answer that question.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, but I think the question assumes that they make that discovery while he's on leave, not 10 days before, or 1 day before.
Right. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Vernon and
thank
Ms.
you.
Brooks. Next case for argument is Jones versus Patrick. Mr. Peters?